back to root down in geometry. Questions about this stuff before I go? All right, here we go. So last time we covered flipping and Bellonian triangulation. So we defined Bellonian triangulation, and we had this very simple characterization of the Bellonian triangulation. In fact, we had two. One was that given a point set, the Bellonian triangulation of the point set was the triangulation, which includes in which every triangle, the circumscribing circle of every triangle, doesn't contain any of the other points in its interior. The other version of this was that the Bellonian triangulation was the projection of the lower part of the convex hull of the points after lifting them onto the paraboloid. That interpretation came straight out of that lifting view of what this in-circle test looks like. Because this in-circle test was just asking about what happens when we lift these three points onto a paraboloid, cut it with a plane, and if all the other points are above that plane, then that circle is empty of other points, and therefore that plane is a supporting plane of this convex polyhedron, which is the convex hull in one dimension. So we got this, both the empty circle property and also lifting. These were the two different views. Lifted into the paraboloid and projecting the lower hull. This is the Bellonian triangulation. So we started with that, and then we said, well, how do we know that it even exists and give a constructive proof that it exists by giving an algorithm that computes it? So we started with a point set, and then we take any triangulation on the point set. So we saw before that there's always at least one triangulation on the point set, and we gave a specific example of one, which was also an algorithmic group. Let's just remember what that one looked like. It started with the convex hull. It triangulates the convex hull any way you like. And then for each point that's left over, we find what triangle it's in. We split that triangle three ways. There's a point, it's in a triangle, split it three ways. And we repeat. Okay, this isn't necessarily an interesting or good triangulation, but it gives us a triangulation of the point set. So triangulations exist. And then we can flip to Bellonian. And that algorithm was very simple. It says, given the triangulation, just as long as there are edges which are not locally Bellonian, then flip them. So while there exists E, such that E is not locally Bellonian, flip E. It's the whole algorithm. Right, it takes the triangulation as an input. One of the things we will do is we're going to kind of combine this first algorithm, which finds a triangulation, with the algorithm that flips it to Bellonian. And hopefully that will give us something good. And at first we'll see that it doesn't, but it's going to require a nice little trick. And hopefully at the end, at least have seen an n log n time algorithm, you won't see yet why it's really n log n time, at least you'll have seen one. Because remember, even this first algorithm to get a triangulation, what's the running time of that algorithm?
N squared?
N squared?
Yeah.
I think you could do an N squared. I think that's right. Why is that? What's the work involved? First, you have to figure out, for each point, you have to figure out what triangle it's in. So, how do you do that? That's the first question. Because once you find out what triangle it's in, you just flip that triangle three ways. And that takes constant time. So, the number of triangles is linear in the number of vertices that have been added so far. So, you have to check only a linear number of triangles. To check if a point is inside a triangle takes constant time. So, you just check all the triangles to see where the point is. So, it's a naive n squared algorithm that will find the points. Find each point one at a time and add it in. So this algorithm, this simple triangulation algorithm, fits into a category of algorithms called incremental algorithms. And we've seen one before. I think, well, you can view gram scan as an incremental algorithm. The idea is that you have a collection of points, you order the points, and after each step, you produce the output, a valid output on the first sum number of points. So, not all incremental algorithms obviously take the point set as input, but incremental algorithms on point sets generally have the form that you order the points. P1, so Pn. And after step I, you have a valid solution for an input, which is just the first I points. Okay, so the way this class of algorithms is very nice for proving correctness, because then you're going to prove it by induction on the size of the point set. And what you do is you just check that adding one more point to a correct solution gives you, again, a correct solution. And so this is what the correctness of the output becomes, a what we call an algorithmic invariant, or a loop invariant, where the loop now is adding one point at a time. You familiar with this term, loop invariant? So you want to, when you want to analyze the algorithm, you look into the pseudocode, you see this loop, and you want to say, what is true every time I start that loop, or every time I finish that loop? In this case, the thing you will claim is that you actually have a valid or correct solution for the points you've seen so far. Right. So this is an incremental algorithm. Flip to Delaunay is not an incremental algorithm, of course, because, it doesn't do any of this ordering of the points. But you can combine these two into the incremental Delaunian algorithm. So here's what that looks like. Just as I claimed here, we're going to order the points. And we're going to add the points one at a time, and each time we add a point, we want to update the structure so it's a proper Delaunay triangulation. So here, what we did in this simple triangulation algorithm was find the triangle that contains the point. Put my main loop here. I equals say 1, 2, n. There's going to be a caveat here, but we'll get back to it. Find the triangle containing pi, split p, split that triangle three ways, and then run flip to Delaunay. So rather than adding all the points into a triangulation and then flipping it to the Delaunay triangulation, we just add the points one at a time and get it back to the one. So obviously there's a caveat here, it's because in the very first point there's no triangles yet. And one thing you can do is say start from point 4 and just let the first three points be a triangle. Start with P1, P2, P3 as a triangle. This still doesn't exactly solve the problem because if I have 1, 2, and 3 here, P1, P2, P3, I could have P4 outside that triangle. So for now, let's just assume that P1, P2, and P3 are a triangle that contain all the points, and we'll go back and get rid of this assumption later.
Finding the triangle containing PI, this part is the orientation test? You can do that with the orientation test?
Yeah, so you'll need to, at least for now, this I haven't said how to do this, but I implied with this case that you could just try each triangle.
Okay.
So you know you have a triangulation, you've got a set of triangles, try each triangle.
Okay.
See if it contains that point. And that can be done with an orientation test. Can we do that in class? Can we do it in homework? Almost, right? It's almost the homework problem. The homework problem asks if they were in convex position.
Yeah.
Well, in that case, it could be any one of the points inside the triangle of the other three. But here, if you actually know which three points make a triangle, and you want to ask if another point is in there, you just have to check the orientations. Do you believe that? Here's the triangle, here's the point. If I have A, B, C, D, it should be what? A, B, D is equal to D, B, C is equal to A, B, C.
I think we did it for polynomials. So.
What's that?
I think we did it in class for complex polynomials.
Yes, okay, good. So you should believe me that at least that one test, testing for one triangle is constant time, and we saw from one of those formulas there's only a linear number of triangles. Right, step I, there's order I triangles. And so at first, it's this algorithm already looks like a quadratic time algorithm, unless we do something more clever here. That will be the bottleneck, but we're not going to get to it yet. Okay, now flipping to Galwani, remember it just took any old triangulation, and it gets it to Galwani by looking for the edges that are bad. And so let me just formally write down the assumption, right? Assume for now that P4 to Pn are in the closure of P1 and P2. So the first three points will say are a nice big triangle that contains all the other points, and then we don't have to worry about a point coming along that's not already in a triangle. Like I said, we will get rid of this. This algorithm, because it flipped to Galwani, really does return a Galwani triangulation of the points we had so far. It more or less trivially satisfies the kind of loop invariant that we want. That after I points, we really do have a Galwani triangulation of those I points. It's not clear then that this is better than just building this, which seems to take n squared time, and then running flipped to Galwani, which we saw sometimes must take n squared time. But let's just draw a picture to see why it might be better. Okay. Let's say I have this so far, and this is my Galwani triangulation. I guess there was some big P1, P2, and P3 are really far away. And I add a new point here. So this is, I'm in step I add point PI here. I add these three. Now, which edges might be I don't want to say a double negative. Of the edges in this triangulation, Which ones could be not locally belonging? There's only a couple possibilities. Remember, we saw that since we know that the red ones actually are locally belonging, because we saw that if the quadrilateral formed by the two triangles adjacent to the edge, if it's not convex, then that edge is locally belonging. So the red ones are all good. The only ones that could be trouble are the three edges of that triangle. Okay. I claim that this is already helping us, because it's really limited where we have to look for edges which are not locally belonging. Okay. If any of these is not locally belonging, what do? We flip it. So in this case, this edge is not locally belonging. We're running the flip to belonging algorithm. We're going to take this one out and add this one in. This one might also be not locally belonging. We would flip that one out. Okay. Actually, let me back it up. Before I do that, my list of edges which are not locally belonging, when I do this flip, it could be now that this edge might not be locally belonging, and this edge might not be locally belonging. So every time I do a flip, the edges, at least two of those edges adjacent to the flip, could cease to be locally belonging. But this is always growing outward in a very straightforward way from the original triangle that we split. And in fact, there's this frontier, you can see this little polygon, which is all a polygon formed by all the vertices adjacent to PI. In fact, these are the only edges which we have to check. So it's growing. If I had to do another flip out here, make this black. At some point, these edges become locally belonging, and the flip to Delaunay algorithm terminates. But it also, one of the things that happens is every flip then, since every flip is on this polygon, is flipping one of these edges out, every flip produces a new edge adjacent to PI. So after we insert PI, it has some number of edges coming out of it, and that, except for these minus three, the three we started with, is the number of flips we had to do. So you remember last time when we analyzed the flip to Delaunay algorithm, the main thing we counted was how many flips we have to do. Now this gives us a quick way of seeing, well, after I insert the point, I know from its degree how many flips there were. Now, remember, Euler's formula tells us that the average degree of a vertex in a planar graph is what, 6, right? At most 6, less than 6. Because the number of edges per vertex is, edges per vertex is 3, so degree per vertex, degree is, the sum of all the degrees is twice the number of edges, so it's at most 6. So, but that means at least on average, if we got somehow lucky, and we'll work on what we really mean by lucky, we should expect to only see a constant number of flips. And so when going through n insertions, even though in a bad case you might see n squared flips, if we get lucky, then we'll only see a linear number of flips. We still have to deal with the point location flux. That's the point location is finding the triangle that contains the point. But we're going to use Euler's formula, and we're going to use some randomness to show that at least the number of flips is not too many. Let me, before I show you how to use randomness, I'm going to show you at least an example, a bad case example, where sometimes you may still have to do order n squared flips. So So it could still be a quadratic number of flips. And here's an example. Suppose I have the points, the first n over 2 points, forgetting about the big triangle for now, the first n over 2 points that are near a circle. I say near, it means they're sufficiently close, but not exactly on the circle, so there really is, it's not a degenerate configuration, but it's near enough to a circle. And I take the point, I should have drawn this picture like 100 times bigger, because they're going to get real small. I mean, hopefully you'll be able to see it. P, n over, point n over 2 plus 1. So the first n over 2 points are here. Point n over 2 plus 1 is near the center. So it will be connected in the Galois triangulation to every single one of these. And we know that the number of flips we have to do was approximately the degree as the number of edges coming out of here. So I had to, point n over 2 plus 1 required something like a order n flips. Now, what I want to do for this bad example is to now add new points so that every time I add a new point, I still have to add that new point will have about n over 2 edges. So let's do it. In fact, maybe I should have put these on a line. Here's the way it works. The next point, p n over 2 plus 2, is just a little bit closer to the others. And this one, when I insert it, it will have to flip. It will first flip this one, and it will flip every one of those edges. And so the next point will also have require something like n over 2 flips. Okay. All right. And now I just repeat that. So assuming I put these points very close together, you can work this out. But what exact coordinates you need, but if the points get, each next point gets a little bit closer to the others, I have to flip away all of the previous edges. And so, right, so for I equals n over 2 plus 1 to all the way up to n, the number of flips is, something like n over 2 minus 3. So the total number of flips just for the second half, right? I didn't even count how many flips I did to get the first n over 2 points. But the next n over 2 points is at least is greater than or equal to n over 2 times something like n over 2 minus 3, but you see immediately that this is some quadratic term. The inspiration for an example like this is that even though the average degree of the vertices in a planar graph is constant, it's at most 6, you can still have planar graphs that have some vertices of very high degree. Like you can have just the example of points on a circle and one point near the middle, that point has very high degree, all the other points have very low degree, the average is constant, but you still have one that was high degree. And now you can make this example so that every time you add a new point, that new point is the one that has the high degree, and you pay for that all the updates you have to do. So the thing that should stick out to you here is that this example is really contrived. In fact, even for this exact same example, you could come up, if you just picked a different ordering of the points, you wouldn't have nearly such a problem. I claim that for this, even for a bad case where there's some ordering that you have to do n squared, that over random ordering, the expected number of flips is much smaller. That over random ordering, the expected number of flips is like think it's like linked. Let's see what we actually get. Any questions? This example kind of makes sense? All right. So there's the idea we're going to use add the points in a random order. So what is it, a random order? This really means that uniform, the permutation of the points, I choose among all possible permutations with a uniform distribution. So any particular or any two particular orderings have the same probability. And you can randomly order points. There's a bunch of nice, simple ways of doing it. Does anyone know any good ways of randomly ordering a point set? I give you as an input point set, how do you randomly order it?
What we do is assign probabilities and then, you know, give a random number generator. And then each and every number I generate is associated with a point and pick that particular point.
I see, yeah. I think, yeah, so you can put a random number on every point and then just sort according to that random number.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think another thing that works, so I think that gives a uniform random ordering.
Yeah.
I think you can run some sorting algorithms if you replace the comparison with like a coin flip, and then you say, do run sort. I think often that will give you a uniform random order. It's kind of common. So you believe we can do it at least. Now let's see that it's a good thing to do. So say P1 to Pn is the random order. So I've just labeled the points so that they correspond to the order we're going to use. And let's just let Qi be the first I points. That's the first I points according to this order. And the first thing we want to show is that the degree of the ith point in the DeLaunay triangulation of Qi is small in expectation. So it's like we expect it to be constant. So we want to know what it is. 3 pi and del qi. Because this degree, right, tells us exactly how many flips we needed to do in that insertion. Tells us how much work we did in this, how expensive was that particular call to flip to the line. Let's call it delta I. Okay, so the total number of flips is let's just put an upper bound on it. It's the sum from I equals 1 to n of delta I. So if we can bound, if we can show that the expectation of this value is bounded, then we get that the expectation of the total number of flips is bounded. So the expectation now is over random orderings. So we're not getting a worst case running time of the algorithm, we're getting a kind of average case running time where the averaging is not over instances, but over orderings of a particular instance. So there's another kind of average case analysis, which maybe I'm not sure if anyone's seen before, but there's an idea that you take some distribution of kinds of input you might see and say, well, on average, over that distribution, I get a good answer. You can view it this way, but really, this is, for any input, I'm not going to have bad inputs anymore. I'm going to show that for any old input, after I shuffle it around, it becomes, with high probability, a good input.
This isn't that different than like a nickel climbing problem, right? If you just said you think we're going to take some random element here and that's going to sort of, you know, it makes it much more likely that it solves efficiently.
I think the analysis is going to be different.
Probably.
I don't know what kind of hill climb, you mean like some kind of optimization problem?
Yeah. Like quite often they're very hard to solve, but then you know there's like a good enough probability that it's easy that you can just sort of try it multiple times. And I guess this is just a little different.
I think it's going to be pretty different.
Okay.
Let's work through it. So if I want to know what the expected number of flips, I know that it's less than the expected expectation of the sum. Okay, and I can now apply this most wonderful technique, which you should probably have to apply almost every time an expectation shows up in any equation you're ever trying to write, which is using the linearity of expectations. So this, the expected value of this sum of random variables is the sum of the expected values of the variables. Okay. An operator is linear if it commutes with sums. If you can distribute it over a sum, that's what it means to be a linear operator or a homomorphism. And the expectation operator is linear. So we can push this through, and now it suffices to answer the question about what is the expected degree of the ith point, given that we pick some random order. So who's heard of backwards analysis? Who's heard of quicksort? Great. You guys just don't want to raise your hands if you really never heard of quicksort. You're like, I'm not even going to raise my hand. Quicksort. Everybody knows quicksort. Well, you know the analysis of quicksort? There's a couple ways you could do the analysis of quicksort. There's like 100 ways, actually. Everyone has their favorite way. One technique. It's backwards analysis. In fact, it's the same kind of analysis we're going to do here. You see, in order to make quicksort work, you know that quicksort, what's the right sound of quicksort? Shout it out.
N squared.
Yes, N squared. It's the worst case N squared kind of algorithm. So quicksort also has this, some kind of, what is it? Is it an average case guarantee?
Yes.
Why do we say N log N?
N log N.
It's N log N, but what's... What do you mean by N log N? It's not worst case N log N.
It's expected.
Expectation over what, though?
The choose the pivot, if the pivot is either, you know, chosen randomly.
Exactly, right? So in order to get that expected N log N running time out of quicksort, you also have this random ordering of points, which is the ordering which you can choose them as pivots. We don't have to think of that way, because quicksort is naturally a parallel algorithm. Once you do the partition, you can do both, you do the two sides independently. But you could think of it as picking an ordering in which you do all the pivots, and if the pivot lands on this side, then I partition that side. If the next pivot lies on this side, I partition that side. So I claim quicksort is very similar to this, but here we're going to have to do something a little more clever because we are in 2D, but we will at least have the advantage of Euler's formula. So if I want to get an idea of what this value is, This is the expected degree of pi in the line of triangulation of qi. Now, the points were ordered randomly. If I try to go forward, if I say, let's look at the next point and try to guess what the expected degree will be, that is, if I look at the next point, how many flips will I have to do? That's actually very tricky to get your head around. I don't know if you can even do the analysis that way, because it's making an assumption about the rest of the points we haven't seen yet. But if you go backwards, the world is a little easier, because now you can look at the I points you have in QI, and with equal probability, any one of them could have been the last one that you added. So since any one of them, because we chose all the permutations with the same probability, the probability that the last any one of those points was the I point is the same. So so for some particular point Q and QI, the probability that Q equals PI is equal to 1 over I. Where again, the probability is over the random orders. But now I'm conditioning on the fact that I've fixed the first I points. Okay. Now this is good because what's the expected degree now? It's going to be just the average degree over all the vertices, which we know is at most 6. So this is at less than or equal to 6. In fact, it's strictly less than 6. So this is less than 6n. Which is a big win. It means that the total number of flips, although it seemed like there, in some bad permutation is n squared, we even do better than that n log n quickster. We say we only do a linear number of flips. This is the probability over all random permutations. And I guess if we, let's condition it. Condition on which were the first QI points. So given that I have some set of I points, there are many different permutations where those are the first I points. Do you believe that? Not necessarily in that order, but there's a whole set of permutations that will have this set as their first I points. And now, over all of them, and for any, if I pick any point in there, the probability that pi is that particular point q is equal for all of them. So drawing a picture, right, that at some step, say this is my line triangulation. I guess it's not good unless I imagine that they're inside a triangle. Any one of these points has equal chance of being the last one added. And so the backwards view of this is that you say, well, if I take a step backwards and instead remove a random point rather than adding a random point, well, the removal is just running the insertion backwards. And you can ask, so maybe the other perspective on backwards analysis is that there's actually an algorithm that you run backwards, which instead of adding the points is removing them. And you can ask, what's the work of removing a point? And there, it's the same as removing a random point. And picking a random point to remove, you'll pay what the cost of that will be, the degree of that point. The expected degree of that point is n equals 6. So at each step, the expected amount of work is And it's constant. So the total work is length. We'll go through that again, or we'll go through, well, I'll give you maybe the expanded version of this next time when we show how to get the point location worked out. In the end, this algorithm, since this part of the algorithm only takes linear time, we still have to figure out how to find the triangle containing the next point. We want to do faster than n squared total time. Is there a question?
I was just wondering, you read the probability of work.
What's that?
What did you write up the probability of for?
Why did I write this? Oh yeah, why did I do this? Sorry. This was just to say that they're equal.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It turns out. Good. So we're going to get this running time. In the end, we'll get it down to n log n. But before we do that, while you're all still digesting that, I did want to show you something kind of neat, which came up last class. There was this question about the angles in the DeLorean triangulation. And in fact, what we'll get is a third item to add to this list, which is a completely different characterization of DeLorean triangulation. And what's nice about it is that the proof will work by using the flip to DeLorean algorithm. Okay, and this next characterization that you get is that not only is the Boyne triangulation the triangulation that has this empty circle property, or the one that you get from projecting the lower convex hull from the lifted points onto a paraboloid, but also it's the triangulation that maximizes the minimal angle. So I'll bring this here. Claim will be maximized in the way among all triangulations. So to prove this, you have to go back to high school, or maybe all the way back to ancient Greece, to a theorem called Vitalis' theorem, which I'm sure you saw in high school, middle school. If you have a circle and a diameter, and I draw a triangle, inscribed in that circle where the diameter is one of the edges of the triangle, this angle is, what's this angle here?
90
degrees. Good. Something like 6th century BC. This is true a little bit more generally. In fact, you can see the following is true. If I take any chord of a triangle, and I look at this angle here, called this theta, and I pick some other point on the same circle, this angle is also theta. Have folks seen that before?
Yes, half the big arc divided by 2. Or yes, half the big arc.
Yeah, so it's...
AB. ACB.
Yes, because... one way to see why this is true is that you just... let's just draw just one for a second. You look at the center here, and you look at this... nice neatly. You draw these three triangles coming out. This angle here, let's call it gamma. This is isosceles, so this is gamma. This is some, well, I call that theta, so let's call this theta. And then there's some other angle in here, call it alpha. And the same angle in here is alpha.
I think you call theta.
What's that?
I think theta included alpha.
So let's give it a new name. Let's call it beta.
Sorry.
Okay, and what I'm interested in is what is alpha plus beta? So no matter where I put C prime, I'll find that these three angles have to sum up to 180 degrees. So 180 degrees is equal to just 2 alpha plus 2 beta plus 2 gamma. So alpha plus beta, which was this, what we were calling beta here, which is this angle, is what, 90 minus gamma? And the key fact is it only depends on gamma. And gamma doesn't change as I move this point around. Now, this proof is not exact because you really have to add signed angles. Because if I pick a point over here, then some of these triangles don't really add up. They don't. The union of those triangles is not the triangle we're looking at. But we add signed angles the same way we added signed volumes when we computed areas of polygons. And I claim that this simple extension is easy to prove. If the point was on the other side, I think you get something like 90 plus gamma over here. So another variation on Pauli's theorem says that if I have a circle, I have a chord, and I have an angle here, and I have some point outside here, this angle is going to be bigger than this angle for any point outside of the circle on this side of the line. So we can put this to work to show that the Dohnanyi triangulation is going to maximize the minimum angle. And the way we'll do that is we'll just show that every time you do a flip, the minimum angle can't go down. So I'll say that again. Every time we do a flip, the minimum angle will not go down. We're going to prove that. Why is that enough? How does that prove it actually maximizes the minimum angle? This is like a sanity check.
When you can start with the triangulation, which maximizes the minimum angle, and then find the
volume. Exactly, right? If there was another triangulation that was better, and we just ran the flip to the Dohnanyi algorithm, we're only doing flips, we're never shrinking the minimum angle, we must be. So the Dohnanyi triangulation has a minimum angle which is at least as big as any other triangulation. Because the flip to Dohnanyi algorithm works. And because flips of edges which are not locally Dohnanyi are only going to increase, or at least non-decrease the minimum angle. And in a really big picture. So here, here is a Dohnanyi triangulation of 4 points. And imagine that I just was flipping. So since the Dohnanyi triangulation had this edge and not this one, this edge is not locally Dohnanyi. If I throw this in for now, I can label all the angles. Let's call this. Theta 1, theta 2, from here, theta 3, theta 4, theta 5, theta 6, theta 8. Okay, so the triangulation before, right, the before triangulation is this one. Has angles theta 1 plus theta 2, theta 3, theta 4, theta 5 plus theta 6, theta 7, and theta 8. So here are the angles I had before the flip, and after. Shall I write them out? Here we go. One, two, three, plus theta 4, 5, 6, theta 7, plus theta 8. It's a bunch of coming. This should be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Six angles in each one. And now, if I do this flip, these are the only angles that change from one triangulation to the other. All the other angles in the triangulation stay the same because all the other triangles stay the same. So I just have to check that the minimum angle here is bigger than at least some angle here. Right, so that this triangulation of just these four points has a larger, or at least does not have a smaller minimum angle than here. So for every one of these angles that I have to find somebody, say, every angle I have downstairs, I have to find somebody upstairs who is at least as small. Okay. And so this follows, I'll start with the first one, and you'll see how all the rest of them are also going to follow from the same variation on Tales' theorem. So yeah, it's not an accident that I drew these particular circumballs. Remember, these circumballs have to be arranged like this in the sense that this point is outside this circumball, that is the Dohany property. And in this case, if we look at theta 1, theta 1 is the angle opposite this chord. This angle, theta 3 plus theta, theta 4, this angle theta 4 here, is also the angle on a triangle opposite this chord, but this point is outside this circle, so theta 4 is necessarily smaller than theta 1. So each angle in this list, by Tales' theorem, we're going to be able to find somebody else to blame. So theta 2 says, well, I might be small, but I promise you that theta 7 is small. Yeah.
So with this picture, I believe that it's outside of that circle, but it's sort of misleading because it's flipped, right? So like the circle on the right is larger.
It doesn't matter the size of the circle.
But then if you just said, like, yes, be outside, then you could just put it right outside of the circle there, and then it's actually not moving anymore.
Which part? Well, where would I? Which point would I? If I put this one right outside the circle?
Yeah, like right there or something. Then it's
still true. Still true. It doesn't matter where I put it because this theorem says that anywhere outside the circle, this angle is small, and if it's on the circle, the angle is the same.
But on that side of that line, right? There's a condition there.
Yes, but I can't put this point. So if I take this line and I extend it, right? If I put it on the other side, then I don't have a triangulation anymore. If I had a different triangulation, I'd have to just flip all of the space around it.
So, like in the picture you drew before, that like line where we're looking at all the ones on that side, the line was drawn on the chord that we were looking at, and this line you just drew is not on the one we're looking at.
I think it's okay. Watch. Let me add a color here. So there's this line here, and I have two triangles on this chord. This one. And I have these two angles, right? It says that the angle at the point outside this circle has to be smaller than the one on here. So this is this line here, looking at this triangle here, or this one, and this one. And so theta 4 must be less than or equal to theta 1.
Oh, okay. I think I was thinking of different angles, probably.
Now, so this Dohany property ensures that this argument gives us an ordering, or at least allows us to always find an angle in the triangulation before, which was small, less than or equal to the angles after the slope. Okay, and so why does this mean that if we maximize the minimum angle, it's just suppose some other triangulation was better. Suppose the min angle of some t is less than min angle of p. Then we flipped it along. Like I can write this as the min angle of flipped to the one of t is less than or equal to the min angle of t. But this is the Gaussian triangulation of t, and so that's the contribution. So it's a nice property of the line triangulations that they maximize the minimum angle. It's a nice use of a standardized version of Pallas' theorem, and it's also a nice way to use the this pretty Clifford-DeLaunay algorithm as a proof technology to prove things about the line triangulations. Any questions?